Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, an opportunity for spoilers in the Syrian peace process. An analyst speaks with us about the U.S. role in the fight against ISIS. An invention giving homegrown a new meaning.
Every 6 weeks, this cube can grow between 100 and 200 vegetables, depending on the size.
And two of country music superstars pay tribute to blues legend B.B. King. It's right here on The Voice of America. The latest push to bring at least a temporary halt to the fighting in Syria continues today, with the United States and Russia trying to convince opposing sides of the conflict to accept a ceasefire proposal. Syria analyst David Lesh of Trinity College in Texas tells VOA's Victor Beatty, given the existence of so many actors in the conflict, it creates opportunities for those who wish to act as spoilers of a truce.
Especially since the regime identifies anybody opposed to it as terrorists, all it will take is one bomb here or there by any of the jihadist or non-jihadist groups that are arrayed against the regime to break the cessation of hostilities from their perspective. In addition, Russia has also adopted this regime point of view, and since it will continue to go after and attack jihadist elements like Jabhat al-Nusra, who in certain areas of Syria have integrated their military activities with the so-called moderate opposition, that will also break cessation of hostilities, certainly from the Syrian non-jihadist opposition point of view. So, you know, despite some encouraging signs, but mainly the fact that at least most of the parties in the conflict are discussing a cessation of hostilities, there's still a lot remain to be seen in terms of implementation, simply because there are so many moving parts that have to be coordinated at the same time. It's difficult to believe that it will hold very long, if at all.
Doesn't this come even as Russia and Syria are trying to achieve their military objectives? They seem to be a little short of that. Why would they be discussing this now?
Well, I think that they know that, as previous attempts have done, they want to appear to be conciliatory, appear to be the ones that are also engaged and interested in a ceasefire or cessation of hostilities. But under their strict definition, they know it's not going to last, and that they can continue to attempt to achieve their military objectives despite the illusion of a cessation of hostilities.
Will we see an uptick in this effort to try to achieve their objectives before, say, a Friday deadline where the ceasefire might begin?
Certainly you'll see an uptick in military activity. This is typical in any sort of ceasefire or cessation of hostility situation. In any sort of war, the parties to any sort of end to violence try to improve their military position and thus their negotiating leverage prior to the implementation of a ceasefire. The Russians and the Syrian regime have a longer-term deadline, and that is the end of the Obama administration come next January, because I think whether a Republican or a Democrat, certainly if that Democrat is Hillary Clinton, wins the election, they're going to take probably, at least on the surface, a more hawkish view towards Syria, whereas the Obama administration appears to show a proclivity to work with the Russians and even the Syrian regime, and obviously not committed to the overthrow of Assad, certainly in the short term. So I think they want to achieve their military objectives, to put them in a position to dictate the terms of any sort of political settlement, particularly against the non-jihadist Syrian opposition, before there's a change of administration in the United States.
Social media reporter G. Abby Lee joins us to talk about the U.S. presidential primaries. Hi, G.
Hi, Susan. Donald Trump at Real Donald Trump wrote this tweet after he won in South Carolina. What a great night. Thank you, South Carolina, a special place with truly amazing people. Love. He also thanked former Republican VP nominee Sarah Palin for her support. Trump also likes to retweet his son, Eric Trump. The latest retweet from him is a picture of them standing in front of their private jet before heading off to Nevada.
And the Republican race was streamlined a bit.
Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush ended his campaign. The account shared a video clip of him announcing the decision with a short and sweet tweet, "Thank you."
Turning to the Democratic winner Clinton, what did she tweet?
There are two tweets about her win in Nevada, and both are from her and not her staffers. Let's read one of them. "To all my supporters out there, some may have doubted us, but we never doubted each other. This one is for you, Hillary in envy." Her rival Bernie Sanders tweeted, "He's very proud of the campaign they ran." He's gearing up for South Carolina, tweeting, Our opponents are funding their campaigns with checks from billionaires and Wall Street, not us. That's all for me today. Susan?
Thanks for the update, G. You can follow her on Twitter at G Abby Lee. Our program's account is at VOA underline IE. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Astronomers from Vanderbilt and Harvard universities have discovered a binary star system nearly 10,000 light years from Earth, where it takes 69 years for one of its stars to eclipse the other. But once it does, the eclipse lasts for 3.5 years. The researchers described their findings in a paper that's been accepted for publication in the Astronomical Journal. This star system, which has no official name, has set a new record for having both the longest duration stellar eclipse and the longest period between eclipses in a binary system. Until this discovery, the previous record holder was Epsilon Origae, an eclipsing binary system that is only 2,000 light years from Earth. That star system's yellow giant star is eclipsed by its normal-sized companion, that's slightly bigger than our sun, for 640 to 730 days every 27 years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
One issue that has many in the United States political scene in agreement is that Islamic State, also known as Daesh, should be defeated. But there is not agreement on how the U.S. should help achieve that goal, especially in Iraq. International Edition's Mohammed Elshenawy and our continuing conversation explored U.S. options with Kenneth Pollack, a senior foreign policy fellow at the Brookings Institution.
What should the U.S. do to protect Iraq from the Iranian influence and the rising alliance between the Syrian regime and both Tehran and Moscow?
Well, the first point that I'd make is that the United States is going to need a certain amount of tacit buy-in from the Iranians to help heal Iraq. If the Iranians choose to fight every American effort to bring about political reconciliation in Iraq and defeat Daesh, then it's highly unlikely that you're going to have a peaceful, stable Iraq. That said, I think that it is possible to secure that. And what's more, I think that the best way to limit Iranian influence over the long term is to have a unified Iraq. If Iraqis feel strong and confident about their future, if they feel like they can work with each other, what we have seen from them is they will push back on Iran, and they are far more effective at doing so than the United States is. So the real trick is to convince the Iranians to go ahead and help us to help unify Iraq, recognizing that that unified Iraq is going to present a great challenge to Iran. The key, I think, to unlocking that situation and making that possible is that ultimately the Iranians do not want civil war in Iraq. Civil war in Iraq is an enormous threat to Iran. It threatens their stability. It threatens their society. They've made it very clear that they would like to see Iraq stable and unified, even if that does ultimately limit their influence there.
Talking about civil wars, how significant is to have a U.S. role in ending civil wars in the region in order to prevent the spillover to Iraq?
Again, I think it is very important. I think that the civil wars in Iraq, Syria, Libya, Yemen, these are the most important events going on in the Middle East today. These have become what I've called engines of instability across the Middle East. And, of course, the biggest problem is that these civil wars spread, so that the civil war in Syria helped push Iraq back into civil war, and we are now watching as Iraq and Syria and Libya and Yemen are helping to create civil war in Egypt, in Turkey, creating unrest in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, Jordan, Lebanon. These are enormous problems, and it's why I think that the United States has to lead an international effort to deal with all of these civil wars, or else I'm afraid that we are going to see the violence and the chaos increase across the Middle East and potentially even produce a region-wide sectarian conflict.
Can the U.S. just disengage from the Middle East?
I don't believe that we can. Certainly there are many Americans who do, certainly Americans who want to believe that. But, you know, my experience of the Middle East is, as we say, it's not Las Vegas. What happens there doesn't stay there. It has a very bad habit of affecting the rest of the world. We see terrorism and refugees inferring from these very civil wars that are now affecting both North America and Europe. And what's more, at the end of the day, while there are many people who'd like to believe, many Americans who'd like to believe that fracking has made the United States energy independent, that is quite simply a myth. As long as the United States economy is tied to the international economy, which it will be forever into the future, and as long as the international economy is ultimately driven by hydrocarbons, which it likely will be for at least another 25 years, and as long as the Middle East remains the world's largest supplier of hydrocarbons, which again it is expected to do for the next 25 years, then the United States is going to be ultimately dependent on Middle Eastern oil for its economic prosperity. And these civil wars have a terrible habit of destroying oil production.
What would you recommend for the new American president in terms of a coherent strategy for the future of a stable Iraq?
I think that the most important thing for the next president is first and foremost to engage with Iraq, to recognize its importance to America's interests in the Middle East and more broadly its economic interests across the board. If the United States is willing to engage, there's an enormous amount that we can do, certainly on the military front, but again, as I've argued, it's in many ways even more important that the United States get more involved in Iraq politically, to help the Iraqis overcome their suspicions and distrust and forge a new power-sharing agreement, which will become the basis for a stable, peaceful Iraq moving forward. This is all possible. We've done it before, but it's not going to happen without the United States.
Kenneth Pollack with the Brookings Institution. Coming up on International Edition, something new for couch potato gardeners. And what's behind a B.B. King tribute? A new tool gives the term homegrown a whole new meaning. It's called a farm cube and grows all sorts of vegetables right inside your house. VOA's Deborah Block has investigated the invention and joins us here in the studio. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Susan.
Well, what is this thing?
Well, what this thing is, this farm cube, which has been developed by a Taipei-based company, is 1 meter by 2 meter, 85 centimeters tall, and it's an enclosed ecosystem designed to grow food indoors. Every 6 weeks, this cube can grow between 100 and 200 vegetables, depending on the size of the, you know, the seedlings and, of course, the vegetables themselves.
Well, how does it work?
Well, the cube is really interesting. It uses hydroponics, which is growing plants without soil, and this is where the nutrients are dissolved in water and fed directly to the roots. Seedlings are placed in the cube that uses sensors. This is automated farming software that controls the correct amount of air, water, fertilizer, and LED lights as the plants grow. Now, a fan directs the airflow. And interestingly, red light promotes the growth of the seedlings, while the white light supports the established plants. All the water is purified by ultraviolet light, so it's safe, and there's no need to wash the vegetables because it's self-contained and there's not going to be any pesky bugs in there. Now, I should mention, with an app, you can also monitor the growing process yourself or make adjustments to the air temperature, humidity, light settings, and even more.
Well, you could grow tomatoes, celery, lettuce, just about anything?
It looks like you can, right now anyway. This particular cube that I saw had lettuce in it, but I think that in the future, this, you know, contraption might get even larger, and we'll see, you know, different types of small and large vegetables growing in it.
Sounds great. Well, how much does this thing cost? And that's bottom line. And how do I get one? I like the idea.
Well, I like the idea too, but I can't afford it.
Oh.
It's quite expensive. You know, all new technology is usually pretty expensive.
Uh-huh.
It's actually $1,000 each.
Yeesh.
That's each cube. Now,
that's pretty pricey lettuce.
It's pretty pricey anything right now. But I would imagine over time that this might go down. I mean, I see the day where, you know, you might go into your kitchen and have a wall where these cubes might be lined up, and you just walk over there and get your lettuce and whatever else you're growing over there, your herbs, and go ahead.
Your vegetable pantry.
Your vegetable pantry. That's exactly
and
right.
And it would be wonderful for people in nations where they have food shortages, because people could just grow it at home.
Yes. I mean, the fact that it's hydroponic, meaning it can grow in water, you don't have to worry about the soil. And also, it's completely self-controlled, so you're not relying on the sun or the rain and the other things that we deal with when we're trying to grow our vegetables and fruit, no matter what country we're in.
Well, this is going to make Mother Nature kind of mad, though.
Well, it might, but I think it's going to make a lot of people happy in the long run.
Right.
You know, unless there seems to be some sort of issues. I mean, we haven't talked about, are these seedlings going to just be from regular seeds? Are they going to be, genetically developed? I mean, that all remains to be seen.
Well, I interrupted you while you were speaking, so I'll let you finish my question, and that is, how do I get one?
For those people who can't afford it at this point, you can get it from the company Opcom Farm. That's OPCOM. The best way at this point would be to contact the company. You can look them up on the internet. They have offices in China, Japan, Germany, and the United States. And the company has started taking pre-orders, so it is on the market.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Deborah, for stopping by and sharing this.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Country and blues music are closely intertwined. The icon Hank Williams Sr., one of country music's most influential singer-songwriters, was first taught how to play the blues at 8 years old by one of his first mentors, blues musician Rufus Payne. So it was no surprise that the 2016 Grammy Awards turned to two of country music's superstars to pay tribute to blues legend B.B. King. VOA Music's Nikki Strong joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to discuss how it all came together.
Nikki, how did Chris Stapleton get chosen to do the B.B. King tribute at the Grammys?
Well, the L.A. Times reported that the executive producer of the Grammys telecast, Ken Ehrlich, saw a YouTube performance of Chris Stapleton singing The Thrill Is Gone, and he heard his vocals and was like, you know, that's the guy. I want him to perform. So he reached out to Stapleton, and he gave him the option of doing one of his own songs or doing the B.B. King tribute. And Chris Stapleton was like, B.B. King, of course. And he said secretly that's what he enjoys and wanted to do, the blues. It was a great opportunity for him. And he also said B.B. King's guitar was on stage at their performance as well.
Oh, wow. Isn't that's
nice?
Incredible. Well, and also B.B. King being from the Delta in Mississippi.
Exactly.
There's that
yes.
very similar. Yeah.
Yes.
So how did Bonnie Raitt get involved?
Chris Stapleton suggested it. He was like, hey, you know, Mr. Ehrlich, can you call up Bonnie and get her on board? And that's exactly what Ken did. And it happened. So it was at Chris Stapleton's suggestion. And they did a great job together on stage, along with the dynamic Gary Clark Jr. I think the performance is really fantastic. And I posted it on our Facebook page at VOA Music.
Tell us about Gary Clark Jr.
Okay, so Gary Clark Jr., he's an award-winning blues and electric guitarist. He's a singer as well. He's an actor. He was nominated for the Grammy Award for Best Rock Song in 2013. And then in 2014, he won the Grammy Award for Best Traditional R&B Performance. And then in 2014 and 2015, he won a Blues Music Award for Best Contemporary Blues Male Artist of the Year. So he's described as a blues rock artist, but his music, as you can tell from his awards, is informed by many different styles, including rock and soul and country and even hip-hop and jazz. His latest project, The Story of Sonny Boy Slim, just sat in the number one spot on the Billboard Blues album chart. If you like Bonnie Raitt and Chris Stapleton and just good guitar playing and sweet singing, Gary Clark Jr. will fit nicely in your collection. And that's why the tribute was also so great. He added another dimension. And he is the youngest of the three who did the Grammys tribute, but I think the trajectory of his career is just as great, and they all stand on the shoulders of B.B. King. And he said that he wouldn't be where he was if it wasn't for B.B. King. And he said his first introduction to slide guitar was actually Bonnie Raitt.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's amazing. So there were all three Grammy winners on stage paying tribute to legend B.B. King.
Yep. Gary Clark Jr. has won. Chris Stapleton picked up two that evening for Best Country Album and Best Country Solo Performance. And Bonnie Raitt has 10. And B.B. the King himself has 15.
Wow.
Yeah.
You can hear more blues-infused country music on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. You can also reach Nikki on social media at VOA Music on Facebook and VOA underscore music on Twitter. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
We'd like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA underline IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States intends to engage in very serious conversations with China after civilian satellite imagery indicated that China deployed surface-to-air missiles on a contested island in the South China Sea. The island in question is Woody Island, part of the Paracel Island chain. The chain is claimed by China, Taiwan, and Vietnam. China has said it will not militarize in the South China Sea, but, Mr. Kerry noted, there is evidence every day that there has been an increase of militarization of one kind or another. It's a very serious concern, he said. China's latest apparent move on Woody Island follows other dubious activities by China in the South China Sea in recent months. In addition to the Paracel Island chain, China also claims sovereignty over the disputed Spratly Islands and, in an enormous dredging operation, has built several artificial islands in the area, some equipped with airstrips, which observers say could be used for military purposes. The United States takes no position on the sovereignty of disputed features in the South China Sea region, but has encouraged the countries involved to solve their disputes diplomatically and peacefully in accordance with international law. In January, the U.S. Navy sent a ship near Triton Island, part of the Paracel Island chain, in order, said the U.S. Department of Defense, to challenge excessive maritime claims that restrict the rights and freedoms of the United States and others. During a press conference at the conclusion of the recent U.S.-ASEAN summit in California, President Barack Obama underscored the U.S. and ASEAN's strong commitment to a regional order where international rules and norms and the rights of all nations, large and small, are upheld. Toward that end, President Obama emphasized the need for tangible steps in the South China Sea to lower tensions, including a halt to further reclamation, new construction, and militarization of disputed areas. He added that freedom of navigation must be upheld and lawful commerce should not be impeded. The United States, said President Obama, will continue to fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows, and we will support the right of all countries to do the same.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.